Hi, everybody. Welcome back. It is the Pat Miller Program. Glad you guys are with us. We'll fire the phones up again probably in about 20 minutes or so. But first, we go to Washington, D.C. Our inside reporter, he covers the White House for Real Clear Politics. It's Philip Wegman. Philip, good afternoon to you, sir. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday, Pat.
So the president, now I'm making an assumption, which usually gets me in trouble. I'm making the assumption that the president went today to the U.N. and you did not go there.
I was not in New York. He traveled with a traveling press corps, but I was following it from here in Washington, D.C. And something that was kind of interesting is that the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, he took the train back to Washington, D.C. from New York, whereas President Biden took Air Force One. And I got to say, if I was given an option myself, much as I love the train, I would definitely hitch a ride on Air Force One.
Yeah, I think I would have too. Maybe it was just me, but you know, normally when a president, any president, speaks at the UN, it's kind of a deal, especially for the people in and around the UN. There were an awful lot of empty blue seats out there today while he spoke.
Yeah, I'm not sure what attendance looked like. I'm not certain if that's a result of the pandemic. But, you know, it is a big deal. This is a major foreign policy speech by the president, and it comes at a time when there have been significant moves by this White House. It's not just the withdrawal from Afghanistan, although that is a very large part of it. It's also questions that we have about the aftermath effect. And one of the big things, you know, in addition to questions of whether or not, you know, our alliances are as strong as they once were, was countering China and Russia and their influence.
Yeah.
Notably, though, the president did not mention either of those nations by name.
Yeah. How weird is that? You know, whether it was Trump or Bush, or for that matter, even Clinton, they didn't mind naming names sometimes when it came up and when they had the opportunity to do it. Parts of the president's speech today, this is me, not you, but it felt like a bit of a duck and weave today. You know, I have to go in and do this, so I'm going to go in and do it. I'm going to do it in a way that I don't step on anybody's toes. I don't want to make anybody mad at me. I want to stay on everybody's Christmas list, and then I'll go back home. But when he talked about the fact of, you know, we stand together and blah, 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 that we are, I think his words were, we're interconnected as never before. after what happened in our leaving Afghanistan and comments that were made from the French and from the Brits, the way we got out, I mean, we basically had one of the members of parliament standing on the parliament floor the next day after we pulled out, because we endangered some of their people too. And he basically told us how the cow ate the cabbage, and he wasn't screaming and he wasn't yelling. You could tell that he was actually speaking in sheer dismay. He could not believe where we were. I'm just telling you, and I'll let you, I've talked too long, but I'll let you pick it up here. But to say that we're interconnected as never before, I view that as a wish and not necessarily a reality.
Well, first, the immediate comparison is between the president and his predecessor, and the address that Donald Trump made at the UN General Assembly and the address that we just listened to today. You mentioned interconnectedness, which was a major theme of Biden's speech. And I think that the top line takeaway here is that where Donald Trump showed up and basically thumbed his nose at the UN, saying that it was going to continue to be America first, you had Joe Biden saying, look, the era of endless war is over, and we are instead, I think his exact phrase was, relentless diplomacy has begun. The thing is, you know, when you, he's correct, you know, the era of relentless war, at least in terms of our engagement in Afghanistan and Iraq and the Middle East, that has drawn to a close. We left Afghanistan. We're not there anymore. We're still in Iraq, but that's at the behest of our partner government over there. So he can say credibly, that era of two decades of war, that's over, you know, for the time being. We don't know what the future will hold. But when he talks about relentless diplomacy, the president has a lot of diplomacy to clean up. There yeah. are a number of folks. You mentioned the British member of parliament who is frustrated. The British are frustrated with how he left. The French are frustrated with how he left.
Well, and they're not really crazy with him either about this whole thing with, oh, by the way, Australia is not going to be able to do nuclear subs with you guys anymore over there in France because they're going to do it with us and the UK.
Absolutely. They are angered. And it's not just that the they missed out on a contract. They're frustrated that the United States has stepped in, made this deal, they weren't consulted, and they're frustrated. Mm-hmm. So he has to repair these two critical, you know, relationships, and he has to do it soon. What we heard, though, in this address was not so much, a pivot towards the Pacific and a focus on the rising threats from China and Russia. Instead, what we heard was climate change is going to be a massive problem. Disruptions in marketplaces are going to be a massive problem because of AI and industry. And he seemed to be extending a hand towards, you know, everyone in terms of, you know, cooperating on that economic front. I'm not certain that the speech there did a lot to repair the relationships with Britain and France. But, you know, the British Prime Minister is here in town in Washington, so certainly he'll be doing work there.
He talked a bit about the sting of terrorism, and while our quickly put together withdrawal out of Afghanistan was widely criticized by not only people here, but governmental officials in a lot of places, he was trying today desperately to paint it as a step forward. The withdrawal was a step forward. Now, I wanted to get out of Afghanistan also, but there are ways that you do things that you might want to do or you don't really want to do or that might be a little bit distasteful. And saying that the United States is now more prepared to address the threat of international terrorism than it was back in on 9/11. Did anybody in the room really believe that?
Well, you'd have to ask them. I can tell you what the White House response would be to that line of questioning. The White House and their allies would essentially say, this president promised to leave Afghanistan, and he did. And withdrawals are always going to be messy, and there's always going to be collateral, unfortunately, and that's what we saw. The problem, though, is that that line of a response immediately sort of begs some more questions, right? Even though the withdrawal generally was bipartisan and everyone supported the idea of eventually leaving Afghanistan, you're totally correct. You have Republicans and Democrats who are furious about the way that it was done.
Right.
And on top of that, there is a huge credibility question here, not just in terms of overall will. I don't think that Biden or Blinken, you know, lack the will to go after terrorists. Certainly, they've shown themselves capable of pulling the drone trigger. But the specific tactical question, not the strategic overarching doctrine, the specific tactical question is, you say that we have over-the-horizon capability. You say that we can go after terrorism wherever it rears its head. Well, the punctuation mark on our 20-year war in Afghanistan was this strike
yep.
that was supposedly against ISIS-K members,
yep.
and instead we killed kids and we killed NGO members.
Yeah, I mean, you've got the big brass at the Pentagon thumping their chest going, look what we did. You know, it's almost like they were trying to make us think this was just like killing Osama bin Laden. And
he said it was righteous.
Yeah, it was a righteous kill. You're exactly right. That's the exact terminology there, Philip. And then to turn around and find out, not only did they not get the terrorists that they thought they got, they didn't get any terrorists. They got three adults who were people that in and of themselves probably working on things that would be on our side, and seven children.
I was talking with a colleague who has covered the war in Afghanistan for quite some time, and she pointed out that some of the blowback here is really interesting, because if you think about it, there are a lot of people in Afghanistan. There are a lot of people who suffered under Taliban rule but had no concept of the attacks on September 11th. They didn't know much about the Twin Towers or the Pentagon. They weren't really keyed in on that. Certainly, you know, the bad guys who were in charge, they knew about the attacks. They offered shelter to Al-Qaeda. But, you know, even in the last two decades, there were people on the ground in Afghanistan who didn't understand. They didn't have a concept of why we were there. And certainly, yep. You know, coalition forces tried to explain. But if you are an average Joe in Afghanistan today, I think that your memory is not going to be of, oh, well, there were all of these geopolitical forces that came together because something bad happened on September 11th, 2001. Instead, your memory is going to be, we pulled out, people died, went to chaos. And I think that that is going to be the lingering memory that is potentially going to create a lot of resentment.
No, it will. Because like you said, they don't have a real great working knowledge on what 9/11 was or what it was like or why it was that it caused such a visceral reaction in all of us, and it did. And I personally think that's okay. But they have no point of reference, no context to talk about that. I mean, the median age of Afghanistan, most of them were not even alive when 9/11 happened, let alone of an adult age where they had a working knowledge of what happened. So in that respect, I get it. But the way that we pulled out, I mean, this just doesn't look like, and I'll let you take this as your last, let's run with it here. This just doesn't function the same way as the knowledge that we came in and got Osama bin Laden. Mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't come across as the same thing.
And in that way, Joe Biden is burdened by the decisions of his predecessors. George W. Bush made decisions that Barack Obama had to live with. Barack Obama made decisions that Trump had to live with. There are a lot of people who could be blamed for why this thing didn't go better. But Biden is going to be judged by how he withdrew. And I think that what's interesting here is while he has promised that he's going to be the elder statesman, the adult in the room who can restore our presence on the national, on the international stage, and then also write things here at home, there is no way to get away from the fact that he promised that he was going to shut down the pandemic. That proved more difficult than he expected.
Yeah.
He promised to leave Afghanistan. That didn't go as planned. And one thing that we're not talking about, because there are these other crises, is what's going on at the border currently. There is no more honeymoon for the Biden presidency, and they have a big uphill battle in that they have to get Congress to spend a lot of money on its infrastructure plan, because that's his marquee promise for his domestic agenda. And if he doesn't do that, the shellacking that Obama experienced in 2010 is going to look like child's play if Democrats don't show some ability to put points on the board.
So you think that difficulty at the midterms is still very much on the table?
No, absolutely.
I'm short on time, but let me ask you a question I've never asked you.
Yeah.
You're in the press room quite a bit, okay? I think I heard something the other day, and I went back and listened to it a few times, and I still heard it. And I'm not going to tell you the question, and I'm not going to tell you the answer. I'm going to ask you a broad question. Are there moments when a question is asked of Jen Psaki, or the president for that matter, and the answer is so arbitrary and so obtuse, and it's such a twist to get out of whatever, that sometimes if you're in the back of the room with the press, you can actually hear an audible groan?
It's Washington, D.C. Almost all the answers are always obtuse and twisted. Sometimes there's definitely an audible gasp.
Listen, there is a Ruth's Chris steak dinner in it for you. If you ever ask a question in that room and the answer brings an audible groan or gasp. Dude, when you come back, the biggest steak you want, I'll take care of it. Okay. I'm trying to give you a career where they'll write about you someday, Philip. Okay.
I'm just in this for the free steak.
So there you go. Philip, as always, thanks so very, very much. Let's hope that some of the things, I don't know that the president is laying the groundwork to make it happen, but let's hope some of the dreams that he's laying out there can become somewhat of a reality. I appreciate this. I appreciate the reality that every Tuesday we have you on here at 5 o'clock. Thanks for being with us today, Philip.
Hey, thank you. Talk soon.
Podcasts by Federated Media.